It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Open Concessions Podcast presented by Toyota, featuring a weekly in-depth conversation with a Chicago Cubs-related personality. We are your hosts. I'm Len Casper alongside Jim Deshaies. You may know us as the Cubs television tandem. JD, I would ask you how you're doing, but I've actually been in your presence a couple of times this week as we are doing daily shows on Marquee Sports Network from Wrigley Field. And I guess since the last time we spoke, the big change is that we get to watch balls hit bats, and it's just fun to be back at the ballpark.
Yeah, spot on. Just being back out there, hearing the crack of the bat and the snap of the leather with guys playing catch and throwing the ball around. It's been very enjoyable. You know, it's funny, you know, kind of a week or so ago, I was looking forward to getting back out to the ballpark, and my hope was that we just talk about baseball, but clearly that's not going to be the case, you know, all year long. This virus is going to be front and center, but, you know, even with that, it's so much fun to have some level of normalcy down there on the diamond.
This week's guest is actually an avid listener to our podcast. It's Tom Ricketts, Cubs executive chairman. And JD, we see Tom quite a bit. He likes to roam around the ballpark during home games at Wrigley Field. That may be a bit of a challenge for him this year, but man, he is as big a baseball fan as there is out there.
Yeah, his story is a great one. Growing up in the Midwest, a baseball fan as a kid, and you know, fell in love with the Cubs when he moved here, met his wife in the bleachers. I think people know that story. We'll go a little bit deeper with Tom on some other issues. But yeah, he's just a really engaging, interesting guy to talk to.
So without further delay, enjoy our conversation with Tom Ricketts. Tom, thanks for joining us this week. Everybody in the world has been basically working from home for the last several months, although we've been at the ballpark here lately. How often have you gotten to Wrigley? Are you trying to get there as much as you can, or still staying close to home?
Yeah, like everyone else, I've been pretty much working from home, trying to get down there like every Tuesday has been kind of my routine so far. I haven't been down in the last couple of days, but I'll be back down tomorrow to check out the new setup that we have to support all the players coming back. So I'll be back a little more often now.
I know we've had these kind of Zoom calls organization-wide, and much of the discussion on those calls are about the health protocols, not just for the players, but really for everybody. And there will be, you know, essential workers who are behind the scenes who will have to be not only at Wrigley Field, but at the team offices as well. Has that taken up a lot of time for you and Crane and Theo, making sure that the workspace is as absolutely healthy and safe as possible here the next couple of months?
Well, absolutely. I mean, the and you guys have probably seen the Major League Baseball health protocols that have gone around. It's a couple hundred pages. I mean, the synopsis that was given to me by our team is 29 pages. So obviously player health and player safety during the games is critical, but it's also the health of the people that are coming in to support the players on those game days. And that's what everyone's focused on at the moment. With respect to the offices, we're trying to keep them as locked down as possible with only essential people going in and out. We, you know, if we can work from home, we would prefer people to do that for the time being. And hopefully over time we'll start to reopen those. But then in the short run, it's just about people supporting the games. And if people are there to support the games, then they're coming in. If they don't have to be there to support the games, then they're staying home.
So it's interesting because MLB has the protocol that you mentioned, and obviously they've conferred with a lot of medical experts. But is there a blueprint for this? I mean, in 1918, we had the Spanish flu, and there's been other outbreaks in other countries. But we've never been through anything like this. So kind of who's the go-to person or what is the go-to resource to figure this all out?
Wow, I don't know. Like I know the league talked with people at the University of Nebraska who have an infectious disease department. That's one of the places that's leading the country in the thinking on this. But I'm sure they've talked to many, many other specialists. And it's just been a long process to make sure we have as thorough of health protocols as possible. And if you've seen them, as you know, they're really thorough. I mean, there's tier one, tier two, tier three type people that are allowed in the park. And then everybody else is to stay away. And so I think the league's done as good a job as as they can to get these protocols in place. Now we have to get used to executing them. And let's hope that it's enough. You know, we obviously want to have a healthy and safe work environment for all the players. And hopefully these protocols will get us there. I mean, there's really nothing you can do to make it 100%. There's no non-risk situations, but I think that, you know, all the work they put into this will make this as healthy and safe environment as we can have.
Yeah, none of us on this podcast is an expert on this. We've all, I think, tried to educate ourselves and our families as much as possible. But the thing that, and I don't know how you feel about it, Tom, I think it's what we don't know. And talking, I have a good friend who is a family doctor. You talked about a lot of the experts the team and Major League Baseball have conferred with. I think that's the trickiest part of this landscape looking forward is it's not necessarily what we know, it's that it keeps changing. And Tommy Hotovy's story in particular, very harrowing in that he's 38. He's about in as good a shape as anybody you'd ever meet. No underlying conditions that he knew of, and he got totally waylaid by this thing for a month. And as you say, there's nothing that's risk-free, and you can even do all the right things and still get it. And I think that's what scares me the most.
Yeah, absolutely. We're learning more every day. And the obviously, for the players, it's just a matter of just keeping them out of situations where they're likely to contract anything and just, you know, hopefully we'll catch it quickly when someone does contract the disease and get them in a place where they can, if they have symptoms, get treated, or if they don't have symptoms, just stay away from other folks. And, I think the protocol, like I said, I think the protocols are as thorough as they can be, and hopefully it'll be enough to keep healthy teams on the field.
Is there a threshold, Tom, in your mind or conversations with other clubs? Like if, four guys in our club come down with it and we have to shut them down and we have to shut down three of their teammates because they've been in proximity. I mean, is there a magic number out there where everybody says we got to take another pause, or is it just a fluid situation and you react as you go?
It's a fluid situation, and the commissioner has the authority to end the season or to make adjustments in case there are some extra health risks. I think that obviously the teams have more players to choose from, expanded rosters on the front end and extra players ready to go down at down in South Bend. So I think we're going to try to play through if we get a few guys sick at one time. We're just going to have to play through and just replace them. But hopefully it'll be isolated and not too many guys at once, so that the league can keep moving forward and all the players that the fans want to see get to play.
As we look back at the 3.5 months during the break, mid-March, spring training was shut down, and we just were able to start up again. Unfortunately, a lot of the headlines around Major League Baseball were about, how to get that accomplished. What was your big takeaway, and was there ever a moment where you were really worried that we might not be able to even get this part started?
Well, every time I got to the point where I was thinking maybe there wasn't going to be a season, I would just remind myself that almost all the owners, at least all the owners I know, wanted to play. And you have to assume that almost all the players wanted to play. And yeah, I think the great news is we do have games that are coming up, and it's good for the game, it's good for the fans, it's good for our country to have games start right now. I think the process over the last 3 months between the league and the union, you know, it wasn't perfect, it wasn't good. I think a lot of times it was a little too public, maybe sometimes a little too personal, but ultimately we got through it to this point anyway. And I hope that right now everyone takes a deep breath and reminds ourselves, both from the club standpoint and from the player standpoint, that we really are partners. I mean, we're in this together. I mean, we are two sides of the same coin. And hopefully as we go into the future and look at other negotiations that are coming up, that we remind ourselves of that, because I would hate to see something that reflects poorly on our game, be part of the next collective bargaining agreement or any other future negotiations. So I'm glad we have games going, and I'm looking forward to hearing you guys broadcast those games. But I think we also have to look to the future of the game and remind ourselves that we're in this together, and we need to do things to build baseball and not do things that distract people from the game they love.
You know, Tom, I remember reading some years ago a polling done, and, you know, a high percentage of people hate Congress, but a high percentage of people like their congressperson. So it's kind of an odd thing. And I think the same thing exists in baseball to a certain extent. I think you hear a lot from players these days because of the negotiations, the owner's this, the owner's that. But you also hear, I love my guy, you know. So are you worried just on a personal level, your relationship with your guys? You've always had a good relationship with your players. And were you able to talk to some of the players during this, you know, reach out to them or have conversations kind of on a one-to-one level?
Yeah, well, JD, I have heard that, you know, people don't like Congress, but they like their congressmen. And I think there is a lot of that here. Frankly, I've never had a bad conversation with any of our players. I think that they appreciate everything that we do for them as an organization, everything that I do for them as the team chairman. I like all of our guys, and I think all of them wanted to come back and play. You know, when it gets to kind of the league versus the union, it gets a little depersonalized, and I think that is a bad place for a negotiation to go, because ultimately our goals are the same. And we'll see where it goes next year. As we look at the next CBA. But once again, I just hope that everyone reminds themselves that this is one game, and we are both going to have to work hard to keep it growing.
Well, you know, in this social media age, I guess the bad thing is that, you know, one quote or one story can really blow up. And with no sports going on, this ended up grabbing a lot of the headlines. But I guess the good news is when you move on to the next thing, and that is we will have a season. I feel like the focus has completely shifted now to obviously being safe and healthy, which we discussed when we began, but really talking about the sport and what the games will look like. And that's really the place we all wanted to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know it's only a 60-game season, you know, not 162 like we're used to, but I think that'll make it interesting. I think it'll be a sprint. There will be no days off, in the sense that you can't, like, let that third game of the road trip go because your guys are worn out. Every game has to matter. And I think managers are going to manage appropriately. Every game is going to have that extra, you know, value on what happens at the end of the season. And I think our guys are going to be ready. I think we're going to start quick. I think Rossi's got everybody in the right frame of mind. Everybody's ready to play. We've had one significant setback on the injury front, but I think everyone else is ready to go. And you're going to have to get out of the gate fast and play hard, and every game's really going to matter.
Where will you watch the games from, Tom?
I don't know. You guys know my routine. I usually just walk around.
Right.
I suppose there is the box I can sit in, or I guess I just pick any seat I want, I suppose. But it's going to totally throw off my routine. I And I really do miss the games. My God, like, you know, the, you know, just the whole routine of getting to the park and, you know, grabbing lunch with a sponsor or doing some pregame stuff on the field and then wandering through the park, saying hi to people I know and saying hi to people that I don't know and just handing out baseballs and doing my thing. I really miss that. It's going to be weird to be at the ballpark for me as, you know, as compared to what I normally do. It's going to be pretty quiet and pretty awkward. But I don't know. Maybe I'll sit with you guys.
I was going to, maybe we could get a spot on the rooftop, hang out on the rooftop, have a beer and yell and scream from left field.
Yeah, we might have the rooftops. That might be a place to go. We're going to work with the city to see if that might be an option for people. I think it is distanced from the players, so that's a good thing. And then they're large enough that you can put a few people up there, and they can all have their own space. I'm sure there's accommodations or other types of things we can do up there to make them more safe. But yeah, the rooftops should be engaged. We'll see.
As a fan, what are you most interested in terms of what will look different? For me, it's, you know, will the quality of play be affected by, you know, the social distancing in the dugouts and the no fan part of it? We have new rules. We have a DH in the National League. We have new extra innings rules. What particular aspect of the new venture are you most looking forward to seeing?
Oh, looking forward to seeing. Well,
we're most interested in how it'll play.
I think that the I think the weirdest thing for me is going to be the fly ball to the outfield and having empty bleachers, you know, in the background. Mm-hmm. And as you know, it's one of the things that we worked on. We bought the club, and for the first couple of years, as we were really rebuilding, one of the things I really asked the people at the team to focus on was making sure that we kept the bleachers full. Because it's such a big part of the Wrigley experience. It's the only large general admission section in baseball, and it just has a vibe to it. And when you see it half empty, or in this case, completely empty, it's going to be a little weird. So I think that'll be odd for me. Hopefully the players, and I think we have the right players, veteran players who will keep it all in perspective, but hopefully it won't affect the players and take away from their concentration on the game or their enjoyment of the game.
Some teams are considering the cardboard cutouts. Am I correct in saying that that's not really something you'd prefer to do at this point? Might that change for fans?
At the moment, we have no plans for that. I think it's pretty clever, and I appreciate it when, like, Dortmund, I think, was the first team to do it. But for us, we weren't sure it was the right look for us and for Wrigley. So we have no plans on doing that at the moment.
Yeah, you're a soccer guy. So have you been watching, and has that been instructive at all in terms of what MLB will look like this summer?
Yeah, you got to give the Bundesliga credit for coming up with a plan as quickly as they did and getting their teams back on the field. Almost 6 weeks ago now, I suppose. I have watched a handful of Premier League games without crowds. And actually it doesn't bother me that much. They do pipe in a little bit of noise when there's a goal. And so it isn't that different, at least in the soccer world. And hopefully fans will appreciate it in the baseball world as well. Hopefully our games will have the same kind of energy, even if you can't, you know, cut away to see fans enjoying the day. But it's different. I mean, as you guys know, I mean, coming to Wrigley is really, it's not just watching a baseball game. It's really an experience. And one of the things that that our broadcasts have always highlighted is the fact that it is just a great place to be. And so in between pitches or in between outs, you can click away to a family having a good time or people enjoying themselves in the bleachers. And it'll be weird not having those cutaways, because I think that's just such a big part of what the baseball experience is. But I think the quality of the game on the field will be very compelling for our fans at home. And on top of all that, I'm looking forward to Marquee. You know, I think Mike, who are planning our games, have a lot of great ideas to bring the broadcasts off the page a little bit and do some different things. And I mean, it should be a great production. And so I'm excited to watching our games on our channel.
We will get back to what is going on now and how the season will look. But Tom, we got to get to know you a little better, because in a podcast form, you can do that. So I want to take us back to, oh, let's see, 8, 9, 10-year-old Tom Ricketts. And what was your baseball fandom like at that time in your life?
Well, I grew up in Omaha. So the Omaha Royals were the AAA club of Kansas City. So when I think of the first baseball heroes I have, mine are guys like Rupert Jones and UL Washington. They were like AAA stars. Rupert got taken away in the 76 expansion draft by the Mariners. And UL Washington went on to play. He was a shortstop. He played with a toothpick in his mouth. I don't know if you guys remember.
Yeah, for sure. I was going to ask you if he was doing the toothpick back then.
Yeah, he was in Omaha. All the kids thought that was pretty cool. So, but, you know, mid-70s, I was a huge baseball fan. You know, and in fact, I really liked your podcast last week with the authors on, because it really struck a lot of notes with me and how baseball became such a big part of my life. But it was, you know, mainly the Royals, because that's who we cheered for, because the players would go through Omaha onto Kansas City. I did like the Cubs. You know, there was, you know, the Bill Madlocks and the Bill Buckners and those kind of guys that I thought were cool. And then, of course, mid-70s, you know, the Reds and the Yankees were teams that I could name all the players on today, probably still. But yeah, we grew up that way. In fact, you know, in Omaha, the Royals are kind of were you know, the team a lot of everybody cheered for. And the Royals in the 70s and through the mid 80s were pretty good. And I remember one time I made a baseball card trade. Because there's a premium on Royals cards, I traded Paul Splittorff, starting pitcher for the Kansas City Royals, to my neighbor for Bill Buckner's Dodger card, and the one with the little Topps Rookie of the Year thing. I don't think he was ever really Rookie of the Year, but, you know, Topps All Rookie Team, little thing in the lower right hand corner. And so I got to do the Splittorff for Buckner trade, until my neighbor Danny decided that he didn't like that trade and I wouldn't do trade backs. I just went home. So he literally rang our doorbell. He doorbell ditched us for a couple hours and kept calling us on the phone and hanging up, trying to force Commissioner Marlene Ricketts to rescind the trade. And ultimately, I had to give Bill Buckner back to Danny. Two kind of ends to that story was Danny actually gave me the card back when I got married. Oh. And I got to tell Bill Buckner that story.
That's so good.
That is so great.
So that's what the seed was planted to be a baseball executive right there when you started making baseball card deals.
Right. And there's times I want to call trade backs, but they don't let you do it in baseball either.
That's so funny you mentioned that. And I don't want to break bad on my son, Leo, who's very well adjusted and is a college student. But about 10 years ago, I believe it was a Pokemon card trade. And he immediately regretted it. And his friend said, yeah, no trade backs. And it was a good life lesson that once you pull the trigger, you got to live with it. Right, Tom?
In life, there are no trade backs.
That's right.
You learned a lesson.
Did you have a big collection, a big shoebox full of cards, or how heavy into the card business were you?
You know, I don't think I ever had the full complete set, but pretty close for those years. And unfortunately, we did lose them. My mom, who's a huge baseball fan, would never have thrown them away. But I do know that ultimately they ended up in some toy chest somewhere in a giant garbage bag and probably still in teams with rubber bands around them. And somehow they got thrown out. They got lost and my parents moved, and I should have taken them with me. But no, I was really into baseball cards, and I'm just a normal kid. That's what we did.
As you grew up and you know, you were a baseball fan along the way, and I'm sure there were moments where you followed it a lot more closely, but was there ever a moment in your young adult life where you wanted to be involved in baseball at all? Or did that moment only kind of happen when the opportunity to buy the Cubs came up?
No, you know, what happened was, at least with me, like, and this happens with a lot of kids, you know, baseball, you're very close to it as you, as you grow up, because you go to games and you watch them on TV, and, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, you're still really into baseball. And then I faded a little bit on it as I went to, you know, through end of high school and into college. And then coming to Chicago kind of reignited me a bit because of my first professional game was my first MLB game was at Wrigley Field. And so I got back into the Cubs. But then after school was over, I was on the trading floor. So I was trading stock options on the CBOE at Chicago, down in downtown Chicago. And so, you know, you talk sports all day long. That's all you do. You stand around with the same guys every day and you have a lot of time and you don't really get to know their personal lives too much. You might know if they're married or if they have kids or something, but it doesn't get too personal because you're friendly, but you're kind of competing against them. So you talk sports. That's like the neutral territory, the DMZ for everybody. So we talked a lot of sports. And then during that time, I started picking up the Bill James stuff and kind of got reignited with my love for baseball through some of the ways he answered some of the questions of the day and the way he posed them. You know, a lot of the orthodoxy of baseball was challenged by Bill James, who was just a fan who at one point working at the pork and beans factory just asked questions different ways and did analysis to try to see if there were different answers to some traditional questions. And so I got back into Bill James. I got into fantasy baseball. I was in a couple of fantasy leagues. And that really got me going on baseball. And about that same time, my brothers and I lived across the street from Wrigley Field. We lived right at the corner of Addison and Sheffield in the what's now part of the Sports Corner Bar. But back then, the Sports Corner Bar was just a one-floor deal, and we were on the second floor. So, you know, between getting into fantasy baseball and living across the street from Wrigley, you know, it kind of, you know, getting into baseball became something that I thought might be an interesting thing someday in the future. And in fact, when I applied to business school, I wrote, the question was, what is your dream job? And I wrote to be owner of the Chicago Cubs. And of course, but I did, and I'll admit, I wrote right after that, but since I may never have $100 million, I may have to settle for a minor league team. So I always thought that would be a fascinating thing. And then of course you get married and you have a bunch of kids like I did, and you get a little bit away from it again. But then when the Tribune was struggling as a company, and knowing that the Cubs were just a little piece of the Tribune, and the Tribune was adding, and Sam Zell ended up buying. Well, first of all, the Tribune was struggling, looking for outside equity, outside partners. And it just kind of went in the back of my head that, you know, maybe someday they'll have to sell the team or they'll want to sell the team. And then that's when I kind of floated it past the family. And then Sam Zell bought the club, and he did he's a brilliant businessman, and I respect him as much as anyone in the business world. But there was a lot of leverage on the team, and the newspaper business was really not coming back. And so it put a lot of pressure on the organization. And as they were heading toward bankruptcy, or as they were struggling at the time, I didn't think they were ever going to bankruptcy. But as they were struggling at the time, I thought at some point, you know, with all the debt that the team has, that they might want to sell the organization has, they might want to sell the team. So, and that's when I kind of got excited about getting in, because I thought we could be good stewards of the organization and just played our cards that way. It was a long, I know, Len, you were around, JD, maybe you were in Houston at the time or something, but mm-hmm. It was a very long, aggravating selling process. It took several years, but and went through the financial crisis. So, fortunately we hung around the rim long enough that when the dust settled, we were owners.
Well, it's interesting because I was here, and early in the process, someone in town who is pretty well connected, just unsolicited, said the Ricketts family, they're going to get the team. And this ended up being, you know, well before anything was finalized. So the question to you would be, there had to be a moment fairly early where you thought you had a really good chance. Was there ever a moment where you got your hopes up and then thought, it's just not in the cards? Or did you feel confident pretty much throughout the process that it would happen?
No. Well, so we put our, you have to apply. So we turned our application in and, you know, I was fairly confident. Look, we have as good a chance as anybody. But if you remember, the way it worked in those days was, you know, the Commissioner Selig had a lot of control over who the end buyer would be. And so one of the other bidding groups was led by a gentleman named John Canning, who's, you know, now he's a good friend of mine. I respect John more than almost anyone. He was leading a group, and he was a minority owner of the Milwaukee Brewers and friends with Commissioner Selig. So there was about a year where everyone said, oh, that's so great, you want to buy the Cubs. But, you know, John's friends with Bud, and so that's what's going to happen. And, you know, and so that always kind of, you know, it kind of bothered me that that's the way it might go. But we got to know the commissioner, and if you know Sam Zell, you kind of think, well, this is an organization that's looking to sell the team at the best price. They're not necessarily going to just go with, you know, who the commissioner likes. And in the end, I think Commissioner Selig was completely comfortable with our family, obviously, and he did not get involved to put his thumb on the scale about who the final buyer would be. But then there was, so we thought, you know, I thought, well, it's an auction, so the highest bidder wins an auction. So that's, you know, kind of what was in the back of my head. And then when the financial crisis really hit, I really felt we had a better chance, because a lot of people, you know, they get quote unquote called owner, but they're a person who put in, you know, 10 or 20% of the money, and they got a bunch of other people to put in money with them. And a lot of guys wrote checks. And in a crisis like what was going on in 08 and 09, it's pretty hard to keep a bunch of guys willing to write you checks. And I just kind of felt like the other bidding groups would have a harder time than we would, because we were just a single family without any, we didn't have to manage, you know, other outside investors at the time. So I felt pretty confident toward the end, but you never know until it's over. There were a lot of twists and turns and extremely complicated transaction. But like I said, we finished strong.
Was it a tough sell to the family, Tom?
A little bit, you know, because, you know, basically it's in a family trust, right? It's money that's been set aside by my parents with great foresight years and years and years ago. And so the first person I ran it by was my dad. And my dad is a brilliant businessman who has obviously made an incredible amount of money, been very successful in multiple businesses too, not just in his main business. And I floated it past him, and he said it was literally the stupidest idea he's ever heard. and I left out the expletive. But I said, well, you know, you said it was stupid, but you didn't say no. So as a salesman at heart, you never take no for an answer anyway. So he didn't really, but my dad's not a sports guy. He didn't have the same kind of love for the team as myself and my siblings do. So one of the things we did during that period of time we're planning on going forward was we just had a big party on the rooftops. We had a bunch of people come and rented out a couple rooftops and threw a giant party. And my dad came to it, and my dad was hosting it in a sense for some of us. It was a big birthday event. And he looked out over Wrigleyville and he was like, wow, I had no idea. And I'm like, yeah, this is what I've been saying. Like, the fact is that this is really more than just a sporting event. It's a family. It's a community. It's a neighborhood. It's something really unique in all of sports. And it wasn't like we said, let's just go buy a sports team. It wasn't like let's go pick an NBA team and buy it. No, it was the Cubs. It was the team that myself and my siblings went to so many games for, and you know just spent all of our time with. And so he kind of understood where we were going with it at that point. And then for my siblings, it was pretty straightforward. All big Cub fans. It was their attitude was more like, yeah, knock yourself out, you know, see how far you get. And eventually, obviously ended up the right way, but But a little bit bumpy on the sales process early on, but we muscled through.
I want to follow up on this, but first, a quick word from our sponsor. Dear adventurers, enjoy a summer of excitement with Toyota. Keep it wild in the rugged 4Runner. With its heritage of toughness, the 4Runner is ready for just about anything. Take charge in the 2020 Camry and conquer mountain roads with its available all-wheel drive. Or plan an epic road trip and get comfy while you cruise with your crew in the roomy Highlander Hybrid and drive confidently all the way with electric on-demand all-wheel drive. Whichever you choose in a Toyota, you're sure to make the most of summer. Soak it up, Toyota. Visit your local Toyota dealer or toyota.com to learn more. We are chatting with Cubs Executive Chairman Tom Ricketts. You hit on something very intriguing in talking about this franchise. And a friend of mine kind of gave me this in terms of like silent auction stuff and how you raise money now versus 10, 15, 20 years ago. Stuff doesn't seem as important to people now as experiences, life experiences. And you can speak to this with the Bricks and Ivy Ball, which has raised millions of dollars for Cubs charities. Invariably, Tom, the biggest priced items are not items at all, but it's a slumber party at Wrigley Field. It's being on a rooftop. And that's one thing that this franchise has that a lot of other franchises cannot have, and that is an experience that is unlike any other.
Yeah, undoubtedly. Like a couple of things that, you know, after we finished the deal for the Cubs, like, you know, just getting to know the fans and getting to know, I would meet, you know, whether they emailed me or I met them in the park or met them at convention. Every time you think you've met the biggest Cub fan in the world, a few days later, you meet someone who could have that same title. And the, you know, the depth of passion for the team and, you know, your baseball team is like a member of your family. And, you know, the ballpark's like the extra bedroom, you know, like it's just like, it really is. It's a special, special experience to go to a game. And then when you talk about how we raise money at Cubs Charities, which I'm extremely proud of, and I could do several podcasts on Cubs Charities and all the great work that our people have done there. But like you talk about the silent auctions, you know, I think as people have gotten wealthier and now they, you know, they own more stuff and they have more things, they are looking for experiences. People ask me what I collect. I always say friends and memories because I don't collect anything else. Like, you know, and the fact is, like, I think there's a lot of people that just, if you can find something unique and something meaningful to you and be able to match it with something else you love, like sleeping in a tent on the outfield at Wrigley, I mean, that's, you know, that raises a lot of money for charities. So anyway, but it all goes back to how people feel about the ball club and how people feel about the ballpark and how important that is.
I don't think this is a question you probably can't answer, but that's why I'll ask it. I mean, how do you even separate the Chicago Cubs from Wrigley Field and vice versa? It's impossible to do. And to me, winning a World Series was the number one goal you had coming in, and you've done that and you want to win more. You've given back, as you said, to the community immensely and immeasurably over the last decade or so. But I think right up there with those two is preserving and really enhancing the experience at Wrigley Field. It's hard to put into words, and for people who've never been to Wrigley Field, they just have to experience it.
Yeah, you know, there's a couple things in there. I mean, first of all, as you recall, when it was time to, you know, to start renovating and improving the ballpark, you know, there's a lot of teams or a lot of other clubs that could just say, well, fine, if you don't hurry up and give me what I want, I'm going to the suburbs or whatever. And, you know, that was never a credible thing to say, because I don't think that any team, maybe the Red Sox, but I don't think any team is so intertwined with its ballpark as we are. And, you know, you talk about the goals. You know, we did state on our first day of ownership, the goals were to win the World Series and preserve and improve Wrigley Field and do more for the neighborhood. And I mean, obviously the first goal, we accomplished that. And as in my chair, I think I had a tiny small part to do with it. But, you know, wins on the field really, they belong to the players and the managers and the guys that really did it. But with the wind at the with the ballpark, you know, if I ever were to think about like a legacy that I have on Earth, I think that I can safely say I've done more to save Wrigley Field than anyone else. I mean, that what we had to go through those first few years, what we had to do to Chicago's just a hard place to get stuff done at times, and with all the competing interests and everything that we had to work through to be steady and consistent and keep our eyes on the horizon and keep pushing forward and reminding ourselves that, I mean, you don't leave Wrigley Field because the mayor just tried to embarrass you in the press. You don't leave Wrigley Field because you have an alderman who gives you a hard time. Those aren't good enough reasons. And so as I look back at, no matter what happens over the next how many years I'm in this job, I'll always be very proud of the effort we put forward to not only save the ballpark for the next 100 years, but to really improve it and improve the area around it.
Is there a what's next, Tom, at the ballpark or around the ballpark? Or do you feel like you've kind of completed the big project and now you can just kind of walk?
The what's next was enjoy it for a few years. And that was the plan for 2020 anyway. Once we got the press box done this spring, we were done with the majority of the planned renovations for the ballpark. And of course, with the hotel opening up and all the restaurants and everything around the ballpark, it was just full steam ahead for this year. So we don't have a big next step. The big next step for us this year is the network, and from the network, you know, focusing on everything we can do to be as close to the fans as possible and give them all the fan experiences and fan insights as we can, because as I tell the players every first day of spring training, like, without the fans, we're all doing something else. And just really refocus on the fan experience. But that's very difficult when you can't have fans come to the ballpark. So anyway, no big plans for next stuff. I'm sure we'll find a few little things to do, but, you know, we're going to run it like it was going to be for a while here.
Well, none of this situation we're dealing with is funny, but you try to find humor where you can. The irony of Marquee Sports Network is you're going to have bigger ratings than ever because people can't be in the ballpark. So it's kind of an interesting way to roll out the network here. And I know, as you mentioned, Mike McCarthy and Mike Santini, everybody at the network is just chomping at the bit to get to opening day, because we got in a nice groove in spring training, and then to have everything stop. I know there are tons of excited people just very anxious to get to July 24th.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm looking forward to it myself. Like, just want to get it rolling. And, and I'm sure we'll learn a few things over the last, over the 60 games that we have, and we'll incorporate them and come back even stronger next year.
We had Billy Williams and Fergie Jenkins on, I believe, back-to-back weeks earlier, about a month ago. And with all that's been going on in the country, they recounted some of their experiences as major league players. In Billy's case, before he ever got to the big leagues, I know you heard some of those conversations and the diversity council being formed at the ballpark with the front office. It's so important right now to listen to those stories, as hard as those are to hear. And in particular, I thought Billy really kind of captured just how many obstacles he had to get over, and really never talked about it a whole lot until he was asked, which is amazing.
Yeah, I heard both of those shows. Billy obviously is just such a classy gentleman and just a sincere honest, direct person. And the way he recanted his stories, or retold his stories, was really great. And honestly, I think you guys did a real service to your listeners, but also for posterity, because we need to hear those stories and we need to keep them. And we have to remind ourselves it wasn't that long ago that a future Hall of Famer had to sit on the bus while his teammates brought him dinner because he wasn't allowed to go into the restaurant. I mean, those or the story about his wife and his friends or the other player's wife having to sit in a different section. I mean, I don't know, for our generation, it doesn't seem realistic. It seems unthinkable, but it wasn't that long ago. But, you know, I think that's, that's good context. And it was really interesting that you had him on your, had both of those guys on your show during the recent events around, recent events and different race issues that have happened in the country. And, you know, it's really been a big thing for us. Obviously, as you mentioned, we have launched a diversity and inclusion committee at the team. You know, we looked at ourselves and said, well, you know, forgetting what Major League Baseball is doing, which I'm sure they're going to be doing a lot more going forward, and, you know, forgetting, what's happening in the bigger picture, you know, what can we do ourselves to be a more diverse, to be more inclusive, and to be more representative of our city? Because I think we've always done very well in hiring and with female executives. We've done pretty well with hiring with, Hispanic, Mexican Americans or other types of Latin Americans. We have a fair number, but with African Americans, it's been harder for us to find the right people and keep them. And we have to refocus on that. And that's one of the goals of the inclusion committee, but that's just one. There's many other things that we can be doing. It also refocuses us on what we're doing around the city. We have a lot of initiatives that coming through Cubs Charities and our other organizations to do what we can for the neighborhoods where young people grow up without a lot of hope or without a lot of guidance. You know, we've built ballparks all over the city, so safe places for kids to go play. But I think one of the things that's even more important than ever is we run programs where we train coaches, trauma-informed coaching and what they call social emotional development, where they basically, try to remind the coach that some of these young people, both boys and girls, are, from non-traditional homes or have really robust challenges, and look for ways to give them, the kind of leadership and really make the sport more about, more about the positive things about team sports as opposed to just are you winning or are you losing. So all those programs that we've run, and Alicia Gonzalez, who runs Cubs Charities, is brilliant and committed and works very hard toward all these things. She has a great team with her, and they're doing a great job of getting those out. And those kind of programs are going to be more important than ever going forward. So we just have to refocus on what we can do at the team and refocus on what we can be doing for the city.
And I would have to think you sleep very well at night from the baseball side of things with Theo Epstein running everything. He's been right out front in not only with the Cubs, but Major League Baseball in discussing some of these race issues. Going back to the trade for Aroldis Chapman, the Addison Russell situation in terms of domestic violence training. These are very dicey and tricky issues, as you know, Tom. But Theo, I think when he speaks about these things, he's incredibly upfront. He's eloquent. And I think even when some people don't agree with maybe certain baseball decisions that have been made, by the end of his description or analysis of not only why the Cubs did it, but how they then took that situation and went beyond to try to make something positive out of it, I think everyone certainly would understand it. And I'm guessing he converted a few people who may not have originally disagreed with some of those decisions.
Yeah, Theo is undoubtedly as thoughtful and thorough as any baseball executive ever. And when we've had these incidences, obviously Aroldis, when we brought him in, and Addison, and then Daniel Murphy, and you know, and when we get these kind of things, we just try to be as thoughtful as possible. And you know, and I think I'm proud of the way we handled these issues. I mean, I really am. I think I think our guys do a great job, and they don't just say, "Oh, it's just baseball. Who cares?" They know that baseball is a lot bigger than just what's happening on the field. It's a big part of our society, and when we make decisions based around what happens off the field, we have to be very careful and thoughtful about what those decisions mean.
So you guys are talking about Theo, and Theo strikes me as one of those guys who is always thinking about what's next. So with that in mind, are you worried about losing him, Tom? I mean, this is a guy who, you know, people keep talking about maybe he has a political future. Maybe he wants to do X, Y, or Z. Do you get the sense that he's content here, or do you think that maybe he's looking down the road?
Yeah, I don't know. Well, you know, he's committed for us for a couple more seasons here. And then we'll cross that bridge when we get there. You know, there's nothing.
I'm asking for Len. Len was curious because I think Len sees himself in the front office.
No. I'm happy doing what I'm doing.
Okay.
Yeah, Len. You know, if we get there, we'll send you the application. I think you know one of the things that that I'm very very thankful for is. You know, in the first couple of years, there was a lot of transition at the Cubs. I think maybe the hardest thing I've ever had to do is to let Jim Hendry go because I love Jim, still do. We're still friends. And the way that Jim and Fleeta and those guys treated me as we came in, I'll never forget. They were just such great people and really helped me as I was drinking from the fire hose those first couple of years. You know, making that transition from Jim was hard, but once we were able to bring Theo in, you know, a lot of the things that I was most concerned about got taken care of. And the other thing that's been really fortunate is the consistency and stability on the business side. You know, Crane was the team president when we closed on the club in whatever 2009, my opinion was let's just get to know the guy. And see how it goes. And the work that the team that he's put together and the work he's done has just been incredible. And so, you know, it makes me sleep easier on you know on the baseball side and sleep easier on the business side, knowing that that we as an organization have two of the top executives, if not at the top of the game, of the top couple in the game. And it's made my life easier. And any success that ever gets attributed to the family, you know, has to funnel through those guys.
Yep, in really good hands with Theo and Crane. And one last question. And you know, I'm as JD said, I'm always thinking ahead, Tom. I can imagine Laura and Todd and Governor Pete listening to this and going, our brother never even mentioned us. We're on the board. JD and I have gotten to know all of your siblings, and they've all been incredibly kind to us. And what I find interesting about the Ricketts children is that while you all clearly were raised right, you all come at it from very different perspectives, and there's a ton of respect among you all. Is that just come from your parents who kind of allowed everybody to be themselves? How did that happen? Because sometimes, you know, siblings are all exactly alike, but that's not really the case.
Yeah, you know, I guess we do have a little diversity in the group there. We all do come at a lot of issues from different perspectives. You know, obviously, you know, it does begin with being thoughtful enough to choose great parents when we all did that. And the, so we, you know, my dad, a great businessman who really worked every day of his life. Like we weren't a family that had new cars or vacations or I mean the house we grew up in was modest, or at least it had a lot of issues with it. We were just a regular kind of like working to get their kind of family as kids. And, but I think the thing that probably, you know, impacted us as much as watching dad grow his business and be that kind of leader is my mom is just a really strong family person. And she comes from a very, very strong family. They grew up on the farm. I mean, my mom didn't have indoor plumbing until she was 14. Like she knew how important family was and that it really isn't all about money and it isn't all about what kind of stuff you have. And so I think she was, you know, the person that really raised us the most at home and, you know, instilled in us respect for others and instilled in us a sense of family. And I think it's served us well over the years. And we have a lot of big differences on the political level, particularly between, you know, some of my siblings, my sister and my brothers or whatever. But yet we all still get together all the time and we're all very, very close. You know, we still have that, that family feeling we had in, you know, growing up 50 years ago.
This has been a pleasure. Tom, thanks so much for the time. And let's have a fun 60-game schedule. And hopefully the Cubs will be playing deep into October.
Yeah, let's hope. I'm pretty confident this will work out well. It'll be a fun sprint, you know, it'll be different for the fans. It'll be different for the players. And I think it'll just be exciting. And I what I'm really excited about, you guys see it as closely as anyone. I just think that David Ross has the right skill set and he has the right guys to get us off to a quick start and maintain a lead and get us into the postseason. And as he said, if they're giving away a trophy, he wants to get it. So I think we're all set up for what could be a really exciting 60 game season and one that people won't forget.
Are you going to listen to this podcast like the other ones?
Of course. Oh, listen to me. I don't know. I'll pretty much remember it. But like but I don't know who's on next week. But I'll listen to that. I liked all of them so far. I liked Woody. I liked Fergie. I liked Billy. All of them.
Tom, thanks so much. We appreciate it.
All right. Take care, guys.
Thanks,
we'll see
Tom.
You soon.
Yep.
Well, I learned a few things that I didn't know before, particularly the time when the Ricketts family had made a bid to buy the Cubs. And as Tom said, it wasn't fast or easy. It took a while, but it's kind of hard to believe that they have owned the club as long as they have, over a decade. And Tom's right in terms of preserving and really enhancing the experience at Wrigley Field. His legacy will include winning a World Series for the first time in 108 years for this franchise. But I think the ballpark part of this cannot be forgotten.
Yeah, and that's a great point. That will always be his legacy, that he was able to make the improvements that he did at the ballpark, around the ballpark, enhancing the game day experience. He gave due credit to the players and the manager and the coaching staff for winning that World Series. But he was a big part of that, too, as well. Somebody's got to write those checks. And I just have one suggestion for Tom. If he ever writes the book, it needs to be in quotes, "That's the stupidest idea I've ever heard."
Yeah, that's what his dad said when first broached about buying the team. And one last kind of overarching thing that I've noticed, and it's not always the case. You played for a lot of franchises. You broadcast games in Houston, and you've now been here for, 8 years? But the family ownership part of this matters. And I think all Cubs employees, you know, they know who the owner is. They're able to talk to him on a very one-to-one level. And that's not always the case with corporate-owned teams in some other situations.
Yeah, and just thinking about in terms of personality, when I first came to the big leagues, I was with the Yankees in the mid-'80s, and George Steinbrenner was the owner. And George did a lot of wonderful things in his life, but that was a different cat, right? That was a different personality altogether. Tom just creates a very welcoming, and everybody over there with the Cubs in the front office, a very welcoming environment for all their employees.
All right, we skipped an admission last week, so I got to put you on the spot. Do you have anything that's been gnawing at you here lately?
No, I don't. That was going to be my admission, is that I don't have an admission.
That's very unlike you.
I know. I drove way too fast yesterday. I was late for a golf date, and I was driving my daughter's car, and I looked down, and the needle was really way too high. So I apologize for that.
Mine is one that I've probably given before and will give again. I like it warm, not into the 95 degrees near the lake. Like, what happened to spring? Like, we went from 50 to 90. Like, could we stop at 72 every once in a while?
Yeah. How about just give us a little dose of San Diego here, people?
Exactly.
It's just a nice, mild weather. And so much, you know, like every newscast here, right, is every weather report is cooler by the lake. I'm not so sure cooler by the lake these days.
Exactly. Special thanks, Max Berman, Joe Rios, Matt Romito, Daniel Green, Jim Olbojkowicz, Shane McGuire, Adam Sobel. For Jim DeShays, I'm Len Casper. Subscribe, rate, review, share this podcast with your family and friends. We will talk to you next week. Open Concessions, presented by Toyota.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai. There's joy in every journey.